Welcome to the Infrastructure Show. I'm your host, Professor Joseph Schoffer of Northwestern University. The Infrastructure Show is designed to present to listeners the reality of America's infrastructure, its condition, why it is the way it is, and what can be done about it. We gratefully acknowledge contributions to sustain the Infrastructure Show from Andrea and Ron DeFeo, Dr. Robert Peskin, and Dr. Raymond Ellis. During the spring of 2019, the media has been full of alarming stories about breaches in levees on the Mississippi and Missouri rivers. Melting snow, followed by several months of record-breaking spring rains, have created a situation that some are comparing to the Great Flood of 1927. Do we need to invest in levees, or are there different and better options? We're going to talk today on this subject with Nicholas Pinter, who's professor of Earth and Planetary Sciences and associate director of the University of California, Davis Center for Watershed Sciences. Nicholas, thanks for talking with us this morning.
Pleasure. Good morning.
Every spring, it seems like we're hearing about levee breaches in the Midwest, in the Mississippi Valley, and in lots of other places now. Are the floods getting worse, or are they getting more frequent?
Well, yeah, this year has been a really wet year across much of the country. It's not every spring that you're getting Mississippi River flooding, but it's been a number of them, leading many people to the suggestion that floods are increasing in magnitude and frequency.
What about the levees themselves? Why are they failing? Are they too old? Are they in bad condition?
Yeah, well, part of it is when you get a flood bigger than what the levee was designed for, it's going to not succeed. So fail to some people means that it actually breaks, goes through the levee, and that does sometimes occur. It can go over the top, and that's happening because bigger floods than the levees are planned for, the age of the levees in some cases, and what we're looking at this year, there's been a lot of interest in the duration of flooding. It's a very long flood season this year, and that does test levees. In some cases, in ways they haven't been tested since 93 or maybe even 1927.
Part of that test, I assume, is that they're underwater, they're soaked in water, and there's increasing possibility that they'll fail structurally.
Right. So these are earthen structures, you know, apart from urban flood walls. These are mounds of sand and dirt. And if you press 10, in some cases, 20 or more feet of water and keep that pressure there for months on end, which has been the situation this year, that certainly creates increased potential for all the threats to levee failure that people are concerned with.
In the central part of the country, at least, who's responsible for flood control along the river system?
Well, it's multiple levels. So most of the levees across the country are locally owned, locally operated. There is oversight at the state and at the federal level. So the Corps of Engineers has interest in levees in many cases. This applies to the levees along navigable waterways. There are Corps permitting for levee construction enlargement projects. And then FEMA pays attention. So it makes a big difference if you live behind a levee that FEMA has accredited as protecting to the so-called 100-year flood level or greater, or if you lack that accreditation.
How good is that accreditation, given particularly that the world is changing?
So, right. So that's a problem. So this 100-year flood level is what some statistician has decided is a flood that has a 1% chance occurring at any given time. And yeah, there's been lots of discussion that what was the 100-year flood 10 years ago is not anymore. Or another way to look at it is if you assume that flooding is not getting worse and calculate your 100-year flood, that's going to be a smaller benchmark, a smaller threshold than if you look at the statistics and say, things are getting worse, then we need to aim for a more robust level of protection.
And are we making those adaptations?
In general, no. This idea about floods getting worse, hydrologists talk about non-stationarity. Apologize for the jargon. But there's a lot of discussion about that. And flood frequency analysis in the U.S. is done with assuming stationarity, that is that things are not getting worse. And that is basically that flooding is a moving target. In many places you can show, not all, but many you can show that this is getting worse. So if you're always assuming that flooding is this stationary target and aiming at flood protection for the future, it means you're always coming up short of the target.
But one of the alternatives, I suppose, would be to say, well, you have to keep investing in bigger, stronger, differently designed levees.
Yeah. So the solution, I think, again, stationarity, non-stationarity, climate change, not climate change, if you like, is just have a more robust safety standard. So at least for a while, in the latter years of the Obama administration, at least for federal projects, they'd instituted a series of higher bars for mostly government projects on floodplains. They included build it to the 500-year safety level instead of just the 100-year. And those higher standards have been rolled back within the last couple of years.
That seems to me to be an important risk, and I want to get to that in a moment. But I'd like to take you to a paper that you published in 2016 in which you wrote that beyond providing protection for floodplains behind them, levees present a residual risk of flood damage. What did you mean by residual risk?
Yeah, residual risk is a really important concept for anyone operating a levee or living behind a levee. And I've heard a couple of great colonels, these are the heads of the districts, the Corps of Engineers, talk to levee residents. And they've said things like, anyone living behind a levee has got to know that it does not provide infallible protection. And the other way to put that is there's two kinds of levees, and I've heard this too, those that have failed and those that will fail. So what residual risk means is that any levee, any time, has the potential for failing or being overtopped by the next flood. And in many cases, that's a small percentage. We've got greatly enhanced levees here in the Central Valley of California, and the vector's headed upwards. Things are improving. But even behind these levees, in which hundreds of millions of dollars have been spent, there's always this low probability, high magnitude possibility that something really bad might happen down the line.
My interpretation is that one of the implications of this residual risk is that I could be lulled into a false sense of security, that the levee's right there, it's going to protect me, and so I'm going to build my million-dollar house, and then it turns out that the risk is higher than I thought.
Yeah, false sense of security is pervasive behind levees on floodplains in the U.S. and worldwide. And research has been done on this. Colleagues at Berkeley have interviewed hundreds of people here in California. And the reactions range from underestimation of their residual risk to complete ignorance. I was giving a lecture at UC Davis, intro lecture on flooding and levees, to a student, and I point out the Pocket neighborhood just southeast of Sacramento, and saying, you know, gosh, there's a lot of housing behind a potentially underperforming levee, and it's a deep floodplain, so that if something were to go bad there, some houses would be more than 20 feet deep in water. And a student walked up right after class and said, well, you see that house on the satellite image? Well, that's mine. And it was half a block from the levee in the deepest part of the floodplain. And she was completely unaware that flooding was even a possibility there.
Yeah, it's frightening what people know and what people don't know. So what are the alternatives to building levees? And I kind of want to point you in the direction of something that you've written about, which is the Dutch Room for the River program.
Uh-huh. So first of all, I have to say that levees are a necessary and useful part of our flood management portfolio. But not every levee is a good project, and there are alternatives. So the Europeans, the Dutch in particular, the impact of calculating their levee risk wrong is really, really high. So after a couple of really bad floods on the Rhine River in the 1990s, the Dutch and the Germans and other European countries sort of reached the end of what they can do with levees. In fact, levees kick in. They make actually floods worse. We can talk about levee surcharge if you want. They said, let's come up with alternatives. And they tested a whole bunch through hydraulic engineering modeling and public participation in the process. And they came up with a new strategy, what they call Room for the River. And that is, after centuries of squeezing as much floodplain land away from inundation as we possibly could, just step back where you can, when you can, as much as you can, move back away from the river, allow conveyance of water through the channel during a flood, allow storage on the floodplain. And although they're looking at large climate-driven increases in flooding on the Rhine and other European rivers, they have successfully managed to re-engineer just that little bit of safety margin back through backing away.
Is that what you've written about when you've talked about, I think the word was strategic relocation?
Yeah. So we've been doing some research into alternatives. There's interest now in what's called managed retreat, which is sort of the opposite of structural flood control, flood protection. So again, two options. You've got infrastructure on the floodplain you want to protect. One is build a wall, levee or a flood wall to protect it, or something non-structural. And there's a range of non-structural approaches. I mean, you can elevate structures on a floodplain or a coastline. You can buy out structures, and that's part of the Dutch Room for the River policy, is some very limited buyouts. And the U.S. has bought out tens of thousands of structures on its floodplain. And then there's another possibility, is that when you've got really localized issues, small towns that have been repeatedly flooded, that have the desire not just to be kind of erased, weeded out, but want to stay together. We've been looking at this sort of interesting case where a few U.S. and select other communities worldwide have just plucked themselves up and replanted themselves, rebuilt themselves wholesale in another spot safe from flooding.
What's the scale of that? Can you give us an example?
Most of the couple dozen relocation projects, successful and, let's say, semi-successful in the U.S., have been under 2,000 people, most of them under 1,000 people. Anything larger than that, it's questionable that wholesale relocation is an appropriate solution. However, there's interesting examples worldwide. Kiruna, Sweden, is in the process of completely moving itself a couple of miles away, not because of flooding, but because the town is built on a large iron ore deposit. And that's 20,000 people with high-rise apartment buildings, 10-plus stories, dense infrastructure, and being well-organized Swedes, plus having a big mining company bankroll, it's a very successful, very attractive model for a larger community.
So it's possible with the right kind of planning.
It's possible.
Going back to the room for the river idea, which is, to paraphrase, making space for the river when the river needs it, does that suggest to me that you're looking at the possibility of dual uses of land? That is, I use the land for one thing, for example, for agriculture for a while, but there are times when I need it to give the river a place to be.
That's one of the big payoffs of a room for the river, or sometimes a managed retreat solution, is that when they're well designed, there's multiple synergistic benefits. So a non-structural, sort of non-structural solution here in California is we have a number of bypass channels, which are basically alternative flood channels during extreme events. But what they found is that this low-lying, unlevied, basically floodplain ground can be used for agriculture almost all years. It can be used for habitat. The waterfowl, the birds here just love those areas, and for groundwater recharge. So again, it's a matter of planning these projects right, but done correctly, there are tremendous synergistic benefits.
The example that I can think of in the Midwest is called the Bird's Point Floodway that's on the Mississippi River that I think is flooded occasionally by the Corps of Engineers for the purpose really of protecting Cairo, Illinois, which is upstream of that point. So it gives the river an outlet.
Correct. The Bird's Point Floodway is like the one in my backyard here, the Yolo Bypass, in its engineering design, different in its implementation. This one is operated automatically on a routine basis and with little political pushback. Bird's Point is operated very rarely, 1937 and then 2011, with tremendous political pushback. Landowners in there strongly opposed every time an operation was proposed, including fighting it to the U.S. Supreme Court before it was ultimately opened up in 2011.
My presumption is that a place like Bird's Point, there was an easement purchased, that is, there was some compensation offered when the facility was developed.
Yeah, inundation easements were acquired on every acre of land inside Bird's Point in the 1930s at the time of construction. But I think it's a matter of how frequently something like that is operated. And there was the presumption of landowners, correctly or incorrectly, that that easement would never be exercised. So that in 1973 and again in 2011, when the Corps proposed activating the floodway for its intended purpose, again, a lot of pushback.
Yeah, people have a short memory and they get used to doing what they're doing. So what does it take to convince people to make room for the river or to engage in managed retreat if the scale is right?
Yeah, right. So we're dealing with that right now. 2019 is shaping up as this huge flood year with a lot of pressure to do something about it. And in many cases, I fear we are turning to new levees, bigger levees, in some cases where those are not appropriate solutions. What it takes, I think, is a big flood, in some cases a repeated flood, for people to take transformative action. But again, then you have to make careful choices. As we've discussed already, if the answer is levees, sometimes for concentrated pre-existing infrastructure, that's the right solution. But look at the alternatives.
It's a big challenge to deal with that. Is FEMA's National Flood Insurance Program a solution or a problem?
Look at National Flood Insurance Program versus the alternative, which was in 1950s and 60s, no such program whatsoever. And prior to NFIP, there was rampant development of U.S. floodplains. Most of the great mistakes in floodplain occupation, floodplain management that we made were made post-World War II in the absence of NFIP. And the program was implemented with the best of intentions, but with an underappreciation of the challenges of doing that on a nationwide basis. NFIP is fraught with challenges today. It has run up over the history of the program something like a $36 billion structural deficit. There is this presumption that the flood program is supposed to be self-funding, self-sustaining, and it's not. And although there is recognition that the U.S. needs to address some of the problems with our flood insurance program, we're on something like the 10th short-term reauthorization right now, with no meaningful reform of that program anywhere in sight right now, at least.
When you talk about reform, what I would look for is some offering people some kind of an incentive, if they've been flooded out, not to put themselves at the same risk again.
Yeah, and our National Flood Insurance Program has those incentives. It has carrots and sticks. The idea was to wean U.S. floodplain occupants off of federal taxpayer-funded disaster relief over time. And it's done a little bit of that. I mean, again, we've bought out tens of thousands of structures built mostly before the program, 1950s and 60s in many cases, but also lax enforcement in some cases, or minimal enforcement has led to many new structures. There is plenty of room for reform and improvement and additional carrots and sticks in the system.
Nicholas, going back to something you said earlier, one of the things that strikes me as a source of risk for us is this notion of the 100-year flood or some statistic like that. And my understanding is the Dutch are much more risk-averse. They work with much more extreme numbers.
Right. So when, whatever it is in the Netherlands, half your country is below sea level, you're much more aware of the risk of flooding and much less tolerant of residual risk. So we tolerate the risk of any flood greater than that, this so-called 1-in-100-year flood. So the Dutch engineer their river levees to a 1-in-1,250-year flood. And for coastal flooding, their barrier system is purportedly engineered to a 1-in-10,000-year flood, although how anyone calculates a 1-in-10,000-year flood is beyond me.
I think they're just a lot more conservative in terms of their design. As you point out, one of the big changes in policy there is they've backed away from barriers and levees to providing room for the rivers.
Yeah, well, again, the Dutch are heavily reliant upon their coastal and river barriers. But they also recognize that, at least on the rivers, they have engineered those levee systems to their logical limit. And that it is logical not to abandon those systems, but just where possible to back away a little bit and give again. This is all about room for the river. This is conveyance and storage during the extreme events. And a little bit of room buys you a lot of extra safety margin.
As we've gone through a series of years where the floods seem to be different, they seem to be getting worse. Do you think that there's a lesson in that that we will be able to learn in the United States to do better at managing our lives in the context of this water?
Yeah, so I think on many river systems in the U.S., the lesson is clear that anecdotal evidence is supported by statistics that many of those river systems is getting worse. And the lesson is we have to recognize what we talked about, non-stationarity, that the floods are getting worse. And when you do that, it puts an onus or requirement of a higher safety margin. That makes that an imperative. So I think the lesson is recognize that and begin moving beyond just the static 100-year threshold that we have to clear to a higher standard. And again, embracing a range of different options and recognizing that if you've been flooded 3 out of the last 4 years, the prospects for the next decade don't look great either.
Yeah, so be careful about assuming that the future is going to be like the past.
Right.
Yes. This is a very interesting discussion. I appreciate having the time to talk with you, and particularly in reading your work. I think if we'll be able to do it, I might try to put a link to that paper on our website so other people can get the opportunity to see it. Thank you very much.
Pleasure talking with you, Joe.
Thanks for listening to The Infrastructure Show. If you enjoyed the conversation as much as we did, please encourage your friends to subscribe to our podcast. The Infrastructure Show is recorded in the Reeves Audio Recording Studios in Evanston, Illinois, under the direction of Jim Reeves, Chief Engineer, with a commitment to great sound. Our producer is Marion Sowers, a journalist with a passion for infrastructure. And I am Professor Joseph Schoeffer. Few people are more curious about infrastructure than I.